Writer Lee Smith's fiction ranges from the woods and hollows of turn-of-the-century Appalachia to the just as complicated urban settings of the New South. Her 7 novels and 2 books of short stories have won a prestigious collection of awards and critical acclaim, along with a strong following of dedicated and very happy readers who wait only and impatiently for the next volume from Lee Smith. I'm Susan McInnes for Conversations. Join me now while we talk with writer Lee Smith. Lee, when I was introducing you, I almost called you Southern writer. It fits because your characters and settings are so incredibly Southern. But a lot of writers don't like that. I'm not a black writer, a woman writer, or a regional writer. I'm just a writer.
I think they feel, well, they feel that term is limiting and therefore somehow pejorative. I don't have that sense because a writer can't really choose her material. You know, you are given your material. It's where you grow up, it's who you know, it's how you first hear language. And so this is my material, and so it doesn't bother me. I mean, I feel like it's accurate.
Yeah.
And I hope it's not limiting. I mean, I hope that anything that's good is somehow transcends its geographical configuration. You know, you never know whether that really happens or not, but I hope so.
It certainly seems to. Did you wonder when you first started writing whether people outside of Appalachia, outside of the South, could connect with your writing?
No, I really didn't, Susan, because I don't think I was writing for a public. You know, I mean, I have always wanted to be a writer. I've always written, even as a child. I wrote all these dumb little things. And I just didn't think of a reader for a long time. I mean, I was writing seriously all the way through college. I wrote my first novel when I was in college.
Right.
And I didn't have a notion of a reader. It never bothered me whether somebody would even read it or not, much less like it or not.
Did you grow up in a family of storytellers?
Mm-hmm.
Come to you naturally?
Oh, yeah. I grew up in Grundy, Virginia, which is in, well, it's not at all like, when you think of Virginia, you know, you think of houses with columns and wealthy people and a certain elegance and grace. This is the roughest place you've ever seen where I grew up in. It's much more like West Virginia. It's that southwest corner of Virginia, which is mining, coal mining, and it's the Appalachian Mountains, and there they are very straight up and down. There's nothing scenic.
No rolling
hills. It's not like
hills.
The Blue Ridge. Mm-mm. Yeah. It's not pretty. It's hard, hard country. And so that's where I grew up.
And did people tell stories to you as you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. My whole family. Well, they won't shut up. I mean, you know, and in a way, I was particularly receptive, I think, because I was an only child. And I was surrounded by relatives. I still have, in my father's house in Grundy, I have a house full of cousins living on one side and on the other side and across the road. And I mean, just tons of people. But because I was an only child, I had time to read a lot and sort of reflect a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
My own children have not been turned out to be readers exactly, and I think it's because I had so many close together and they all amused each other so much. So I was receptive to all the storytelling that went on in my family, women as well as men.
A lot of your books center around women, their lives and their struggles.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a main focus for you in your writing?
Well, actually, not. It has come to be, but it has developed gradually, I think. I mean, I think I've become more interested in thematic concerns as I became older. And I have just been really, I've also done more and more in the way of documentary studies and mm-hmm. oral histories, and I have become more interested in women's lives in particular because they have not had a voice. And for so long, and so many of them have not, because their sphere has been domestic in a way and not public, as so often with men. And so I have, in my own writing, a lot of times tried to give a voice and a real interest in the lives of women who otherwise don't have a chance to speak up, if that makes any sense.
Good sense.
Yeah.
Let me introduce you to listeners and viewers who may not know your works, and remind people who do. The first book that Lee mentioned that she wrote when she was in college, an award-winning book, was called The Last Day the Dogbushes Bloomed. It came out in 1968, followed by a book fairly hard on, you're publishing frequently, called Something in the Wind, and then Fancy Strut in 1973. Her most recent books, working backwards, are a collection of short stories called Me and My Baby View the Eclipse, which came out in 1990, and before that, the much acclaimed Fair and Tender Ladies, which is the story of one woman's life from the beginning on through.
Mm-hmm.
When you, this book, Fair and Tender Ladies, begins at the turn of the century and works forward. When you started to write this book, did you have a sense of collecting one woman's oral history? Was that an important thing?
Well, actually, no. Actually, Ivy Rowe, who is the main character, is more of a composite of a lot of women's stories, and women that I have known, primarily women in my own family and women that I have spent a lot of time talking to. In particular, one woman from Abingdon, Virginia, outside of Abingdon, Virginia, named Lou Crabtree, that I've done a lot of interviewing with. And so I guess I was trying to make Ivy be a vehicle for several stories, I guess.
Who does she become as she merges all these other people to you?
Well, it was funny because I had taken a lot of notes. I had done a lot of work before I actually started writing, but as soon as I started writing, it was like all the sources kind of faded away for me, and Ivy took on her own voice in a way that was profoundly exciting for me. I have never written anything before where that happened. And it was like every day when I would sit down to write that novel, it was just like Ivy would write it. And I just didn't have to do anything except figure out how to get the time to sit down.
How'd that feel?
It was wonderful. It was very exciting. It was just very exciting. As I say, I had done a lot of work before. I had planned out and I had a plan. I knew sort of where it was going, but I've never had that sense of the book writing itself. So that was terrific.
Does it feel like a possession in some ways?
Oh yeah, it does feel exactly like a possession. It feels like, okay, this is a voice that wants to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was trying to do there was just trying to write an average mountain woman's life. I mean, somebody who lives and has a lot of children and works real hard and dies and is not memorialized sort of in any way. And I just wanted to take, you know, all those events which happened to us all and try to treat them with the dignity that I think they deserve. And so that's what I was trying to do.
Is she a strong woman for her
life? She's very strong. Oh yeah, she's absolutely strong. And I think that's another thing I was trying to do, was to write, I had always wanted, and it's a real challenge, I had always wanted to write a novel with a strong woman character. I mean, someone who was victorious in a sense, triumphant in a sense, in that she lives by her own convictions, regardless of, you know, the times and the opinions of others and so on. And she's, you know, she's very strong. And this is hard to do. This is real hard to do because fiction is not the province of self-realized characters.
She has to evolve.
Yeah,
right?
she has to evolve and so on. And and most characters in fiction are people who are less sure of themselves maybe than Ivy is. So I guess I had the conflict come from the circumstances of her life rather than as much from her inner struggles. It's hard to write a book about a good person.
Mm.
It's hard to write a book about a strong person.
It's just
the nature of fiction. It's just hard, you know.
Do they become less interesting than
weak
people or angry, vicious, or...
Yeah, or struggling people.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people who are strong and go through life with a certain, you know, gusto are not found as often in fiction, because conflict is the nature of fiction, and a person in conflict over what they believe and so on. More so, the conflict in here more derives from the difficult circumstances of her life, from the poverty, from the lack of birth control, from the fact that she is essentially confined by this ring of mountains, by geography, and also by biology, by having so many children, because these things did circumscribe a woman's life in the mountains, and still do in many cases.
This book is told in a series of letters that Ivy writes. Where did you get the idea to write letters from Ivy to the world?
Well, I had been trying for a long time to think of how to cover the span of a woman's whole life without writing a book that was 1,600 pages long, which nobody would read. And so I love to go to yard sales. I think I said this last night. And I went to a yard sale in Greensboro where there were these three mean sisters who were selling everything that was had been in their mother's house when she died. And they were selling, you know, Tupperware and china and glasses and clothing and this box of letters. And it turned out that their mother had saved all the letters that her daughters and sister, in particular, her sisters, had written to her over her whole life. And she had filed them and so on in this big cardboard box. And I said to the daughters, I said, well, are you going to sell these letters? I said, don't you want to read them? And they said, uh-uh. And so they were selling them. So I bought them because I just thought it was horrible that nobody would read them. Yeah. After she had saved him her whole life. And I went home and read them. And while none of them was particularly literary, the thing that struck me was how, just from reading these letters, I had this incredible sense of fullness and wholeness of that woman's life and also her sister's lives that had written to her. And I thought, well, maybe letters would be a good way to cover a huge span of time. Because, you know, you can have one letter, and then 3 years later, you can have another letter and allude to lots of stuff that happened in between. So that's what I was trying to do.
Can you read to us a bit from Fair and Tender Ladies?
Sure, I'll read just a little bit. Let's see.
While Lee's looking, Fair and Tender Ladies once again emerged in 1988. Tell me who published it.
Harper and Row.
Harper and Row,
yeah.
Published it. All right. It won in 1989 the Sir Walter Raleigh Award. And there's more about this story we'll tell as we go on in this period of time.
Okay. I'll just read a little bit from the beginning. This is where Ivy is writing. She's been urged by her teacher to have a pen pal and to write to her pen pal. And she writes this long letter, which is ultimately not sent because the teacher judges it to be inappropriate for reasons that will probably be apparent. But this tells you a little bit about her life, I think, and about her family.
She's how old?
She is 13 when she starts writing this. Okay. She's talking about they live way up a holler, which is the name for a valley where I'm from. And she's talking about her father, who is sick, and her mother, and so on. So let me just read you where she's telling about her family. I'll tell you about my family now, and my sister Sylvanie will be first. I love Sylvanie the best, you see. Sylvanie is so pretty. She's the sweetest, all silver-haired like she was fotched up on the moon. She takes after a princess in a story, Sylvanie does. Her and my brother Babe was twins, which runs in the family. Sylvanie is 5 years older than me. But something is wrong with Sylvanie. She had brain fever as a baby, and now she will never be right in the head. It don't matter, she's so sweet, but she scares easy. Sometimes she'll put her apron up over her head and start in crying, and other times she'll get to laughing and she can't stop. You have to pour a gourdful of water down over her face. Mama says she run a fever for days and days. It's burned out a part of her brain. So Sylvania don't go to school, but you can't tell it just to see her. She's the prettiest thing. She's bigger and older than me, but it's like we are the same. Sometimes it's like we are one. We've slept in the same bed all of our lives and done everything as one. I'm smart, though. I go to school when I can and try to better myself and teach Sylvania, but she can't learn. Lord, me and her have had some fun, though, just us. We get us a piece of tin sometimes and some rocks and build a little stove right out in the woods and make a cook fire under the tin. Then I'll take out the meal I have stole from the chest on the porch and wound up in my skirt and get some water from Sugar Fork, and we'll make up some little pancakes and have us a party right there in the woods by the creek. We put Black Eyed Susans and Queen Anne's lace in our hair. And so this is about growing up in the mountains. As we go through the book, Ivy gets older, and it goes right through until her death, which was just real hard for me to write. Mm-hmm. I had a real hard time with the end of it. But it...
Did you have trouble leaving her like you would a relative or a dear friend?
Oh, I did. I had to go to bed.
Did you?
I went to bed for about 3 days after I finished writing this book. It was just devastating to me to finish it. I've never gone back and read the ending since I wrote it. I just can't go back and read it. I've never gone back to read it. Although, as I say, it's not, in a way, it's not sad, because she has come to terms with all the circumstances of her life and with who she is. And if we could all have an ending that would be satisfactory, it would probably be like hers. But it was real hard to write.
When you're writing, are you talking to yourself and your characters and to the world about struggle and coming to terms and peace? Do you find Lee Smith?
No, I'm not. When I'm writing, I think the word that you used, possession, is more accurate. When I'm writing, what I'm doing is just telling a story, and I'm just totally out of my mind, I guess. I mean, I'm not Lee Smith. I'm not myself doing anything. I'm just not there. Okay, I'm just writing the story. And then later I can go back and somebody can say, well, this is about such and such. And of course it will be about it, and it'll be about something I feel strongly about, perhaps, like, like the role of women, that women have had to play in Appalachia, and so on. But when I'm writing the story, I'm not thinking about any of that. I'm just not there, I guess, is the best way to put it.
How do you see the role of women in Appalachia?
Well, this book is, I have two sons, one 20 and one 21, and the younger one had not read it until, I guess, last year, and he read it, and I said, well, what'd you think? And he said, well, it's just all about birth control, isn't it? He said, it's just a tract for birth control. And I said, well, yeah, it kind of is. But it's about, about how important it is for us to try to have some control over our lives. And these are fairly new ideas. These are still fairly radical ideas.
I wonder if in some ways they're radical ideas throughout the country, not just in the South.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. Well, I think that's what I mean. I'm sure. Right. As much so here as elsewhere. So.
Lee Smith was born in 1944 in Western Virginia, as she said, in the town of Grundy, the only child of a large extended family. She took her B.A. from Hollins College near Roanoke, Virginia, a small women's college, and is now a professor at North Carolina State University at Raleigh in creative writing, and has been since 1989. Also a fellow at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University for the years 1990 and 1992, and this past spring a visiting professor at Duke.
Well, that was just part of working for the Documentary Center. So.
I wanted to ask you about translating sound to a page. A dialect is so much more than written speech patterns. It's also the difference between the way you speak and the way I speak. Mm-hmm. How do you make the reader's ear go to the page?
I don't know exactly. You have to be able to hear it. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to hear speech. And this is something I teach a lot, and I love to teach, and this is something that I find the hardest to convey to my students, because either they have an ear for dialogue and dialect, or they don't. And if you have it, you can just sort of do it. You can train yourself, though. You can, and I think that's one thing that my students tell me that's really good about starting to write, whether you ever write for publication or not. Once you start writing, you start listening real carefully to everything, you know, and you start looking at everything real carefully, and the world opens up in a really wonderful way. I mean, it's just because you're just paying so much more attention to everything you're exposed to. And you hear lines as good lines. You know, you hear somebody say something and you write it down. You know you're going to use it or whatever. So it's a matter of, I think it's what Flannery O'Connor called a habit of being. Mm. It's a way of learning to listen. And as I say, some people are born with it, other people can learn it, and still other people have kind of 10 ears. But a lot of it can be learned, I think.
And that must help you become the vehicle you talk about.
Yeah.
Help you become possessed, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. Once you do it enough, then you feel comfortable with, you know, writing in somebody else's voice or writing in the voice of somebody from another century even or whatever. And then you feel comfortable enough so that you can just let go while you're doing it. You're not as conscious of it.
The professor comes out, the grandmother comes out, the little girl comes out.
Right.
You've written, as we said, turn of the century, and you write a lot of present day material. Is there a difference in the way you research for one or for the other?
Oh, sure. Well, I for a book like Fair and Tender Ladies or Oral History, I really do a lot of oral history with older people, and I love to do it, you know. And I do a lot of research. I do a lot of poking around courthouses. I do a lot of reading of people's letters and just all kinds of stuff, poking around. For the more contemporary novels, sometimes I do what I would call research and sometimes not. For Family Linen, one of my favorite characters in there is a beautician, and so Candy. And so for that, I worked for 5 weeks in the Kroger Plaza Beauty Coiffure, sweeping up. They wouldn't let me do, they would let me shampoo and sweep up, but they wouldn't let me cut hair.
Geez, I wonder.
I know, exactly. it was great. And I learned a whole lot. But I just, to get Candy right, you know, and to have the vocabulary, you know, and to know the brand names, to know about Redken Airset, and just all this different kind of stuff. So I'll do that kind of thing frequently. Right now, I was writing a book about country music, and I have just been spending a lot of time, as you would imagine, in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And I rode on the bus with Miss Kitty Wells. You know, different things.
Yeah. It seems to me a lot of writing time has to be what I think of as percolation time.
Sit and stare. Mm-hmm. This is very hard for the people you live with to understand. And it's very hard when you begin writing. My students always say this, particularly say people who begin writing in their 30s or 40s or something. It's real hard for them to justify the time.
You're not working.
Because they don't appear to be doing anything, you know, and they feel, you know, whereas they could be washing the dishes, you know, or whatever. And it's real hard, but it's so important to just sort of let the well fill up and to sit and sort of think things through and vegetate a little bit. So I've never understood these writers who say in interviews that they write for 3 hours every day. I don't know what they have to say. I don't have that much to say, and I've written a fair amount, you know, but I would never have enough to say to actually write for 3 hours every day.
What do you do?
Well, I read a lot, for one thing, and I hang around in grocery stores and bowling alleys and places like that listening to people, and when I'm writing something, like when I'm writing a novel, if I can get off a semester from school or whatever, well, I will write for 3 hours, maybe 5 hours a day. But then I'll go long periods of time when I don't, when I'm just letting the well fill back up.
Do you ever worry?
Reading.
Do you ever worry I don't have another story in me? It's been too long.
No.
No.
I don't. Uh-huh. I mean, I know I'll probably maybe come to the point where that'll be true. But so far, I'm the kind of writer who probably writes too much. I have also written 2 unpublished novels that are dreadful and innumerable stories that are dreadful. Because I think a lot of times in order to understand an idea, you just have to sort of wade in and write your way through it and throw away big hunks of it or your first try at it or whatever.
And is that ever, does the ego ever get in the way? Is that problematic? Or do you just say, that didn't work?
I just kind of say, well, that didn't work. Yeah. I think of it more as a craft, I think, you know. And I think of a story not as a part of myself that's on a page, but as a thing that can be better or worse depending on what I do to it. You know, I mean, I really do think of it as a craft, as a thing to be shaped and made, you know, and perfected or just whatever.
But it's outside of Lee. It's not Lee's heart, soul,
right. No, it's
left
not.
Arm.
Uh-uh. It's not. It's not. And I think I have taught poetry classes some because I love to read poetry, although I'm not a poet, but I think with poetry, sometimes the people who write poetry are much more attached. It's much more a personal expression of the actual direct self. But you always have characters who are not you, you know, in fiction. And it's easier to consider it as a craft, as something apart from the self.
As a craftsperson then, are you, when you're writing a novel, also working on a new thing in writing, a new technical problem, or?
A lot of the time I am. I think one thing that is very dangerous for all of us in any of the arts is once we find out that we can do something, our tendency is to keep doing it.
Same
thing. You know,
thing.
To keep doing the same thing, keep doing variations on the same thing. Mm-hmm. If you write well from the point of view of a young protagonist, to keep having a young protagonist and writing initiation novels over and over, or
was
whatever.
That part of the challenge of Fair and Tender
Fair
Ladies?
Fair and Tender Ladies was a real challenge. Well, number one was the challenge to write about a really strong character. As I say, that's kind of hard. And another one was, the challenge was just to write a whole life and somehow get it into the, you know, between what would be a reasonable length of a book. Mm-hmm. And I think still another one was to just portray accurately her times and to, you know, use the research and so on that I had. And I think each book presents a different kind of problem. And I try not to do the same thing again just because it interests me to do different, to do new things.
That's, again, part of the craft is constantly challenging the craftsperson.
Yeah. And just, you know, trying. And of course, you will see the same themes resurfacing and recurring and so on, but I really do try to set a new goal, I guess. It's much more interesting.
This is Conversations, and we're talking with novelist and short story writer Lee Smith. I'm Susan McInnes, your host. Do you have preferences for short story or novel? Or does it depend on the story you're trying to tell?
Well, that's a funny thing. I used to love short stories best, by far. Mm. But I think now that I'm so old that I'm liking the novel more. Because, you know, the older you get, the more you see things happening through time, I mean, happening out through extended time. And I find that real interesting. I mean, the older I get, I guess, the more interested I am in the long haul.
Continuity.
Yeah, and just the longer view, a longer span. So I still like short stories, but in this is the most recent book, and in here there are...
Me and My Baby View the Eclipse.
Yeah, there are two stories that are almost novels, because I couldn't make them stories. It just seemed that it went on more.
Would you take those extended short stories and turn them into a novel now, or are they done?
Well, I don't know. They're kind of done, but that they were never sold to magazines, to publications, because they're too long. So I do think, in a way, I'm coming, and my students so often write absolutely brilliant short stories, just brilliant. And I'm coming to think of maybe that the short story, in some ways, is the province of the young person. Because they're just, it's like a lyric poem, you know, you've got to just, it's a great intensity of feeling and a sort of an intensity of vision. It's a condensation of novelistic thought and prose. And so I still like to write short stories, but I'm tending toward novels now for whatever reason.
I wonder at that, because so many people say the short story, like the poem, is so challenging because it is condensed, because you've got to put so much into such a small space.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. And one ought to think that, okay, the more you've done it, the easier it would be to do. But for me, the longer I keep at it, it seems like I'll think of one thing and then I'll think, well, but on the other hand, you know, and I'll just see more possibilities.
Stretch it.
Yeah, you know how people's lives just seem infinitely more complex to me now than they did when I was younger.
The fortunes of living.
That's right. Gray rather than black and white.
Right.
It takes a novel to get it all in, I think, for me right now.
I want to ask you more about oral histories, the general generic topic, oral histories. Is partly your interest in collecting and developing oral histories an interest in preserving the South?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What took you there?
Well, when I was growing up in Grundy, Virginia, I really didn't have, and as I say, I was surrounded by actually famous storytellers, particularly my Uncle Vern, who was in the legislature and was just renowned, and other people in my family. But I wasn't interested a bit in that or in hearing their stories. I heard them all the time, and I could care less. I was just dying to get out of town, you know, like so many kids growing up in a small town. And it was only really after I was about 30 years old that I suddenly felt enough distance, you know, so that I didn't feel sort of enclosed so much by my family and the mountains and so on. I felt enough distance to where I just suddenly realized that was the most interesting place I had ever been. And those were the most interesting people, whether because I just know so many stories about them or what, but that was true. And at that same time I began to realize that, I also began to realize that it was a way of life which was passing. Because mainly of TV. I mean, I think that's one, you know, those mountains now, every single holler has got these, you know, disc things, these satellite discs just sprouting up like mushrooms. And instead of sounding like me, all the children are beginning to sound like Dan Rather. And I just wanted to kind of, you know, and then they built a McDonald's and a Long John Silver on the bend right around the road from my daddy's house. And suddenly, you know, I just think everybody in this country ought to treasure everything that is regional, everything that is specific, everything that is different. I mean, I feel like the whole country is turning into Cincinnati, you know, turning into a mall, becoming homogeneous. And I just really wanted to try to preserve something that was not that way. And so I love to try to write and use the dialect Because it's going to be gone. I mean, there's not going to be anybody. I don't speak in dialect now. I mean, I can write it because I heard it enough and because I've researched it and so on. But just to have a record of the way it was before we are all homogenized, I think.
Are there things in the homogenization that you definitely fear being lost besides just regional character?
Well, yeah, I just think... I think it's very important for any person to have a sense of who she is, you know, and where she's from and who her people are and what kind of roots she comes from and why they are like they are and so on. And I think this is, of course, being lost inevitably all over the country through... through many things, not only TV in terms of our language all becoming the same, but through divorce, you know, through the breakup of families, through increasing mobility, the way people move, through all kinds of things like the loss of institutions such as the church and of family customs and of communities that would ritualize events and so on, and it's, you know, there's a lot that's being lost, I think.
The writers are some of the artists that preserve and carry forward then.
Yeah, and I think there are a lot of people interested in this besides myself. I think this is a trend that to be interested in regional writing is a trend right now among the general American reading public. I think that's why, for instance, a book like Louise Erdrich's Love Medicine, you know, which is a Native American, is so interesting. Or Amy Tan's book, which is, you know, both books have been on the bestseller list because they, you know, they capture the Chinese American experience, which is very different and very special, consequently. I think even something like the enormous popularity of Garrison Keillor and Lake Wobegon. You know, we all, you know, who has listened to Lake Wobegon? Yuppies, you know, people in apartments in New York. And why? Because we all have some kind of nostalgia for a little corner of the world that's weird and cantankerous and just ours. Sort of. And I think, you know, so I think it's a good time to be a regional writer.
I think also that Amy Tan's grandmother is not like my grandmother, but my grandmother comes up as I read about Amy Tan.
So that's right.
It doesn't just connect me to someone else, it connects me to myself as well.
Yeah. I think that's true. So I like to celebrate, I think, any region that is special and any kind of characters that it might produce. Because I think it's not not too long before we'll all be much more alike than we will be different from each other.
Would you read for us again?
Oh, sure. Let's see.
Once again, for folks who are listening, we're talking with Lee Smith, a Southern and regional writer, and pleased with it. The latest two books, Me and My Baby View the Eclipse, published in 1990, and Fair and Tender Ladies, published in 1988. She is a professor at North Carolina State University at Raleigh, where she teaches creative writing. Lee Smith.
Okay, I'll read you something that is more, a little bit more contemporary. And this is from a story named The Interpretation of Dreams.
Okay.
And I wrote this because I love to go not only to yard sales, but to outlets and outlet malls. And I went to this outlet mall in Burlington, North Carolina to buy towels. And when I went in, nobody would wait on me because everybody was in the back of the store clustered around this one sales girl who had had a book in there on how to interpret your dreams. And she was interpreting everyone's dreams. And she would look them up alphabetically, like apple means such and such. And, you know, horse means, you know, man or whatever. And so it was all going on, and I just loved it so much. I never did buy my towels, but I wrote this book, and this story. And I'll just read the first little part about it. This is a character named Melanie. Melanie stands dreaming against the open door, the entrance to Linens and Things in the Outlet Mall in Burlington, North Carolina. It's raining. Melanie loves how the rain sounds, drumming down on the big skylight at the center of the mall, right over the potted plant in Orange Julius. It sounds like a million horses running fast, like a stampede in a Western movie. She loves movies. She loves Clint Eastwood. Now, what if he came in the Outlet Mall right now and walked over to her and said, "Excuse me, ma'am, I need a king-size bedspread in a Western decor." She'd say, "Why, yes, come this way, sir. I've got exactly what you need." Only the trouble is that he won't come in, probably, or any other real man either. Men don't come to outlets, unless, of course, they happen to work there, especially not to Linens and Things, which is where Melanie works. She's between men. Stan left Tuesday for a new job at WRDU in Raleigh, which has a soft country format. Stan the Man, they called him on the radio. What a joke. Melanie and him didn't really get along that good anyway. It was mostly a mistake caused by too many pina coladas. Stan turned out to be real self-centered, like most media personalities, at least in Melanie's experience, and she's known several. Like, sometimes you'll have a boyfriend for a while, and then you'll go out with his buddies after that, which was true of her and the guys at WHIT. All their voices were so loud, plus they were kind of neurotic, which is often true of artistic types. Melanie would like to steer clear of artistic types now and find a person who is basically down to earth, which she is. So there's a little bit about Melanie. But I like to write contemporary stories, too.
Do you sit and chuckle when you write?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do. I think, you know, that too is a kind of a paradox, though, because I think a lot of times comic writers, which I often am, and people call me, I think I have a sort of a dire view, you know, in a way. I kind of take a real serious view of things. And I think if you're like me, you've only got two choices. Either you can lock yourself in a closet and say, "Oh, no."
And weep, right?
The world is terrible. And weep, or you can make a joke, you know, which enables you to kind of go on. I mean, there's something that's very corrective and sort of affirmative and so on, and that's good in being able to take a comic view. But it doesn't mean you're a dingbat. It just, you know, it just means that's the only thing you can think of to do to bear the whole thing.
I read in getting ready to sit down with you today that you said most writers you think are death haunted was the phrase you used.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense, but I wonder why. What's your context? What makes you think that?
Well, for one thing, just simply because of the ones I know, I think. And also, I think that most people don't have the desire to sit down and write. I mean, I think you only have it if you're sort of a worrier, if you're worried about serious things. And also, if you... it is a way, I mean, in a sense, it's a way to escape death, to fight it off a little bit, to write something, you know, it's like the Yeats sonnets or something. Mm-hmm. Take down this book, you know, and read these words when I'm gone, you know, that kind of thing. I think most writers that I've known are much more aware, I suppose, of death and aware of the fragility of relationships as well as lives and so on, and they just sort of scramble to set something down, to get something straight. I mean, I think the impulse to write is an impulse to order events, because all you have to write out of is the events of real life, and they are chaotic.
Chaotic.
And
yeah.
They often don't make sense, but when you write a story, you take a character from here and something that happened here and something that happened to your Aunt Eula, you know, or whatever, and you put it all together, but you can order it in a way that you can't order what happens in your life. And so just for a minute, it's just very rewarding to be able to do that.
This isn't true of every writer, but it seems that you treat your characters with humor, but very gently. You could paint Melanie so that she's ridiculous, but she's not.
Oh, but I love Melanie. Yeah.
And is that it? Is it because you love her that you...
Yeah, I don't... I am really, really... I have to like the characters that I write about, even if they are ridiculous. I often write about fools of one kind or another, because I sort of am one. But I have to. I'm just interested in what makes them the way they are. And rarely do I have a true villain. I mean, sometimes, but rarely, because I think it's rare to find a true villain. Mm. Usually once we understand what's shaped somebody, they don't seem quite as bad. You know, I think I'm interested in people, actually. I sometimes think I would like to have been a shrink or a psychologist or something.
Or the next best thing, a writer.
Or a beautician. They are psychologists.
This is Lee Smith, and you're listening to Conversations. Is that, do you think, the source of irony in your books? And I say that without telling you what that is, but... The fact that most of us walk around thinking we know what's going on when we don't?
Yeah, I don't think we do. Yeah. I don't think we have a clue. And I sort of write about that. But, I mean, I think most of my characters generally are, like I believe most people to be, sort of well-meaning, you know, and within the context of what they can understand, which for all of us is not a lot.
No, a narrow band.
A narrow band, yeah.
Is that also one of the pleasures of writing? The character has the narrow band, and you've got the rainbow, you've got the full spectrum.
I think that's right, yeah. And I think another one of the pleasures of writing has to do with something that Ann Tyler, who's one of my favorite writers, once said when she was asked why she writes. She said, "I write because I want to have more than one life."
Ooh.
So, which is another thing of being, goes back to being death-haunted.
Sure.
But I think that's really true because, and the older we get, you know, the more we realize, well, we're stuck in this one body, in this one personality, with this one husband, with this one family. And you get beyond the point, you think, well, I'll just go off and get a PhD in anthropology. I mean, you know that there's a whole range of things that you will never do. And there's a whole range of things, of people that you will never be.
It gets more and more limited.
And
as
it gets
you get
more
older.
And more limited. And so there is something that's just wonderful about being able to imagine and then get inside the skin of people unlike yourself. I mean, I was never Melanie. I'll never get to be Melanie. But it was just so much fun to be Melanie for a little while. And it's just so it offers. And also, too, I think it offers a way of... for me, a kind of a self-therapy, in a sense, often a way of coming to terms with situations I don't understand or people I don't understand, trying to put myself in their shoes and feel some empathy and see what they're up to, what they're like, and so on. And that's been real helpful.
Is it fun for you that you also ask us to do that?
Oh, well, see, I don't think I think about the reader enough. I still don't enough. I know because I know this is a big thing in the teaching of English now, is the whole, in literary theory, is the whole notion of reader response.
Mm.
You know, and I just don't think about my readers very much. I guess I should think about them more.
Well, wait, if you got your readers into the writing room, would they mess up the words? I mean,
I think they might because, frankly, the only times I have ever tried to consciously conjure up a reader and keep the reader present in my mind when I was writing were the times when I wrote something that turned out to be really bad.
When
I was trying to write for a specific market, I wrote a whole novel for the young adult market and trying really hard to imagine this reader and to imagine what I understand to be the criteria for those, you know, for young adult fiction and so on. And it was just not good. It was very stilted. It didn't flow for me.
Well, this is another block question that I was wondering about. When you were in college and then later, too, you wrote for newspapers. So you were, it seems to me, writing fiction and nonfiction at the same time. I sat and looked at your biography and I thought, I'd get hopelessly confused.
Yeah, well, I did.
Oh, good.
As a matter of fact, I had to, it was getting to a serious pass because I was, I was fictionalizing the news, okay? I was making up quotes.
Wait. I don't think the car crash should be on Elm Street. Didn't work at all.
That's right. It's much more interesting to put it by the river. But, so I was doing that. And then I was also, the newspaper work was messing up my fiction because I was, just writing choppy sentences in order of descending importance and so on. So finally I realized if I wanted to go ahead doing both kinds of things, that I would have to make a delineation in my mind. And what I did was kind of crazy, but I still do it. I started writing all my fiction longhand and nonfiction straight onto a typewriter or a keyboard, I still do it. And therefore, I can, and because I still write a fair amount of nonfiction, and I just do it straight onto a keyboard. And in the fiction, I write longhand, and that somehow keeps it sufficiently separate in my mind.
It's like the proverbial Japanese screen.
Yes.
Separates realities.
Yeah, it is. And so that has worked pretty well. But at first it was quite hard.
In other ways, does one craft inform the other? Do you learn from writing nonfiction ways to approach fiction and
I think so. I think it's of inestimable value for any young would-be fiction writer to work on a newspaper for a couple of years for several reasons. One is simply because you stop thinking of words that you put down on the paper as a big deal.
Yeah.
You're used to having editors slash through them. You're used to having the ends 7 inches cut off the end of your story. Mm-hmm. You're used to going over to your friend's apartment and seeing that your piece has been put down for the cat, for the dog or whatever. And you begin to think of it more of a profession or a craft and stop thinking of yourself as some neat artiste in a black turtleneck. And this can only be good for you. You begin to think of the whole notion of writing in a much more reasonable way. Plus, I think there's nothing better than being a reporter because just that profession gives you entree into people's lives and into worlds where you cannot go just on your own. You can go into people's homes and ask them personal questions. When you're writing feature stories or when you're covering anything, it's just wonderful because you have an excuse, you have a reason to be there. And a fiction writer really is a voyeur, absolutely. And this gives you the window to peep through, and it gives you, because we are so circumscribed, by the circumstances of our lives, by the people we know and so on. And this puts you out into whole other circles, people whose lives you could not have imagined had they lived. And certainly you couldn't have gone to visit them. Hmm.
If someone among the listeners today would be interested in doing an oral history, as some people, genealogy and other things, and they asked you, how would you say start? Call Aunt Ida?
Do you mean doing an oral history right of themselves or of Aunt Ida?
I don't know. It just occurred to me, not of self, but of say, the family or of a group of people they're interested in.
Well, see, I think this is so important to do, just to capture down, not for publication, but just for ourselves and for our families and to have a record of things, the way our lives are all changing so fast. Yeah, if it's Aunt Ida, call Aunt Ida up and say, I want to come and visit. I want to come talk to you. And you will be amazed because before I began doing this kind of thing, I thought that Aunt Ida would not talk. I thought Aunt Ida would be hard. She would say, don't bother me. I thought it would be hard to get her to speak up. I thought she would be put off by the tape recorder in particular. But what you find is you can't shut them up. You can't shut Ann out or anybody else up. People are just waiting to be asked. And so often, old people in particular have nobody to listen to them. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of stories to tell. One of the best things to do is to just, and there's no technique. I mean, you know, I teach oral history classes, but there's nothing really to teach. The main thing is that you should go with and be really interested and not just ask questions, but talk back and say, oh yes, that must, you know, that's kind of like the time when such and such happened to me, or I remember Mama talking about that kind of cake, or just whatever it is, and just react, you know, very enthusiastically, and that will really
get them going.
Yeah, and it's also best to do it, to not plan to get Aunt Ida's whole story in one afternoon, because once you've talked to somebody for 20 or 30 minutes, that's probably enough. And then you'll leave, and then they'll think of everything they forgot to tell you. So if you're coming back the next day or a couple of days later, there will be a flood of things that she forgot. And you will have, in the meantime, listened to the tape and thought of many more things to ask. And so just plan, you know, 3 or 4 conversations.
Is this just great fun for you?
I think it's great fun. Yeah, I mean, I really do. I think it's great fun. And I think most people do who get into it. It's really seductive. It's wonderful. It's really wonderful for Aunt Ida. And more, I have had people call me up and say, I want you to come back over here. Or I want you to go talk to Olive. You know, or whatever. I mean, I have not had any problem with reticence or with people not wanting to talk. Of course, now, what I'm doing is just learning things or documenting things for my own self. And sometimes I learn things or hear stories that I will weave into fiction. I think if you're interviewing somebody and you plan to publish your interview, or you hope to, you should tell them at the outset. Say, well, if these conversations turn out to be as interesting as I think, you know, I might want to type them up and show them to you, you know, and see if I could get them published or something. Because a person, if you're planning that, I think it's only fair, you know, because you are, in a way, to publish that without their consent or them understanding that they were divulging all this with that possibility, I think is an invasion in a way.
You know, I asked you a bit ago whether you ever worried if you'd run out of stories. I would think that you'd worry that you wouldn't have time to write them all down at this point.
I think that's more the case. Yeah. You know, and different things lead to other things. As I say, I was you hear one idea that will trigger something else. I was recently visiting my Aunt Millie, who lives in a retirement complex in Florida. And that was fascinating. I mean, all these people, and you know, this country is full of people 75 plus years old, and they're still leading these very complicated and interesting lives. And not only do they have stories of their past to tell, but the way they're interacting now, you know, and so on. It's just so interesting. I mean, there's a whole new sort of culture of the old that is something that I would be real interested in. I would be real interested in writing a novel set in a place like that, you know. So, I mean, I just thought of that. And I think, oh. You know, when will I do this? But I mean, I think there's more stuff to write than I can ever figure out when to do, because I do like to teach, too.
A reminder that we're talking with Lee Smith. I mentioned earlier that her novels and short stories have gathered a number of prestigious awards. Among them, this year, 1991, the Robert Penn Warren Prize for Fiction. In 1990, the Sindhurst Grant for Country Music. Is that for the country music research?
Oh, what that is, that was probably a typo. It's Lyndhurst Foundation, and it was a grant it has to do with the Center for Documentary Research, where I'm a fellow, and that bought me some time off from school to go and do the research for this country music book.
A lovely part of writing, I would think.
Oh, yeah.
And as I mentioned, the Sir Walter Raleigh Award for Fair and Tender Ladies, that was in 1989 and 88. These are just one a yearly. 1988, the Weatherford Award for Appalachian Literature, and in 87, and there are certainly awards earlier than that, in 1987, the John Dos Passos Award for Literature. How does it feel to have a play made out of oral history? Two, actually, and then it being, do you call that commissioned for or bought for by PBS?
Well, it just, it feels funny. I mean, it's like it's like having a child in a way. You know, you just have this child, and then they're going to go off in the world, and you don't know what they're going to do. And I think my feeling with all of those kinds of projects, actually, I've had several plays made from different things, including one from Fair and Tender Ladies that went to New York for 11 weeks this past year. And I think that's wonderful, but I didn't try to have any input that's or exercise any kind of artistic control, because I just felt like that the person who wants to take it into another medium has got to have full...
That's her life or his
life.
Yeah,
yeah. I don't know how to write a play. I don't know how to write a script, you know, or a screenplay or anything about making movies. If they want to have it, I'm just delighted, and I hope that would happen. But I'm not going to try to get in there and tell them what to do, because, I mean, that would be like me telling somebody how to take an appendix out. You know, I mean, I just feel like the differences are really great between these different genres.
Would you go watch?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, I did. I just went to a play just a couple of days ago that was made from family linen, and it was just fascinating. You know, and I went to watch. I was a groupie. I went to rehearsals. I went to this and that, by and so forth. I just had a real good time.
Huh.
So.
The book that you're writing now, are you at the writing stage?
I just finished writing it. And I'm at the revising stage, which is a real painful stage to be at. But it was a lot of fun. It starts before the Civil War, and it's about, over several generations, the history of a singing family in country music, such as the Carter family or the Ritchie family from Kentucky or the Stoneman family. And it kind of traces country music from its beginnings from the primitive Baptist shape note singing. And I'm just so interested in early churches. So from that, and from the Medicine Show, and from the Scotch-Irish, the ballads, the Scotch-Irish ballads, and so on. So I go way back and try to show, you know, how it, with extensive sort of stuff, with the barn dances, you know, the big radio bar. I love radio, and I love everything about radio. So it was just so much fun. I just listened and listened and listened to all these old tapes and things, and then the Opry all. And it, you know, it ends up in the sort of Opry land, you know, in the Nashville of today. And I had a lot of fun. I wrote a lot of songs for it.
Something absolutely to look forward to. Lee Smith, this hour's flown. I want to thank you for sitting down.
You.
We'll look forward. What's the name of this book? Do we have it?
The name of the new book is The Devil's Dream.
The Devil's
Dream. Which is a fiddle tune. It's an old fiddle tune.
To be looked forward to.
Goes through.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Hope you'll join us again next week. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations.